so good.
Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Regardless of race or ethnicity, breast cancer is the second most common cancer for all women after skin cancer. This year, an estimated 230,000 women in the U.S. will be diagnosed with invasive breast cancer. Despite better treatments and increased access, 40,000 women still die from the disease every year. So what explains this? Why are those numbers increasing? In the 1960s, a woman's lifetime risk for breast cancer was 1 in 20. Today, it is 1 in 8. And as the month of October unfolds, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, you will most likely hear more and more statistics like these. You'll also see a lot of pink ribbons on a wide range of products. The companies selling those products say that a portion of your proceeds will go toward breast cancer research. Billions of dollars are raised every year to fight the disease. So how is that money being spent? Joining us to talk about breast cancer prevention, the latest developments in treatment, and where resources are going in the fight are Karuna Jagger, Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action, a national nonprofit whose mission is to achieve health justice for all women at risk of and living with breast cancer. Breast Cancer Action is the only breast cancer organization that has taken a stand against fracking and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It does not take any funding from corporations, and it started the Think Before You Pink campaign. And Karuna joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Amanda Wheeler, a board-certified surgeon who specializes in the surgical management of breast disease at Stanford Health Center. Amanda is actively involved in clinical research and serves on the Education Committee for the American Society of Breast Surgeons. Her published research includes the impact of screening mammography on the morbidity and mortality of breast cancer, utilization of breast MRI, the link between obesity and breast cancer, and risk factors among the African-American population. And she joins us on the phone from Stanford. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. So, Karuna, the Breast Cancer Action is celebrating 25 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
25 years. So much awareness has been raised. How many gains have been made? I mean, where are we today?
Yeah, it's a great question, and we are reflecting actively on that. At this moment, when it's hard for us to say we're celebrating, we are recognizing and honoring some really tremendous accomplishments, but so much work remains. You know, we were founded by a group of women in the Bay Area living and dying from breast cancer, and they were angry that their doctors couldn't tell them why they got the disease in the first place, worried that they couldn't prevent their daughters and granddaughters from getting the disease, and you know, really upset that there weren't better treatment options. And so, you know, if you look at their original goals today, while there have been a few true breakthroughs in breast cancer treatments, for the most part, we are still looking at what's often called slash burn and poison, you know, and I think that these are treatments that come with very significant short and long-term physical side effects for women, you know, not only during treatment, but affecting their health for the rest of their lives. You know, the we have been making some progress, and I'm looking forward to what your other guest has to say about mammography screening and really turning the tide on what has been a mantra for too long. And you know, I think we are seeing some progress and real shift there in understanding of the limitations of mammography screening and attention to the harms of over-treatment. There are still grave inequities. We know that Black women are 40% more likely to die of breast cancer than white women. Latino women are 20% more likely to die of their disease. These are unacceptable inequities in breast cancer outcomes. And we still don't know what causes most breast cancer, despite the billions, and it is billions with a B, raised in the name of breast cancer. Most women, you know, cannot say that they know what has caused their breast cancer. It is not family history for the most part.
Well, you brought up so many issues there, and we'll talk about all of those throughout the show. Dr. Wheeler, what would you add to that? When you reflect back on, say, 25 years, what are your thoughts on the gains that have been made?
Right. So breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among women in the United States. If you go back to women that are now getting screened at age 40, because we do recommend screening start at age 40, if you go back 40 years, we've actually made great strides. So 25% of all patients with breast cancer 40 years ago died a result of their disease within 5 years. Now the overall survival 40 years later is 90 to 98% for all stages of breast cancer. It is true that we have multimodality therapy, which helps with the treatment, but that also does cause significant side effects. So we use surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and hormonal therapy that all serve a role in controlling the disease. But because we're doing such a good job with women surviving, they're now living with the side effects of the treatments. And so our next step really is the forefront of survivorship. And hopefully we'll convert this disease to a chronic disease or be able to come up with a cure rather than still trying to have patients survive with their disease. But we've come a long way. And the result of that is really from mammography screening, which has gone up considerably, but also our multimodality therapy.
Dr. Wheeler, for those of us who are not familiar with breast cancer or the treatments, can you talk about the gains that have been made in that area? Why are women who have breast cancer living longer today?
Right. So 40 years ago, there was the National Cancer Act was signed, and that was into law in 1971. At that point, mastectomy was the only accepted surgical option. There had never been talk of a lumpectomy or breast conservation therapy. There were a very limited number of systemic therapies, which were chemotherapy that just kill any cell that grows rapidly. Tamoxifen was still 6 years away from approval at that point, and there was only one randomized trial of screening mammography that was underway. The BRCA mutation hadn't been diagnosed. And so all of those things have actually come about in the last several decades and have really led to a huge survival advantage. It is true, though, that with that comes overscreening and overdiagnosis. So the pendulum's sort of gone the other way, and now we're trying to kind of center it back into the middle and figure out, okay, which patients really deserve these multimodality therapies, and which patients can we offer more selective, high-risk screening on, and maybe not over-treat a cancer that may not cause harm in the end.
Right, and we'll talk about over-treatment also on today's show. But Karuna, what would you add to that? What would you say about the gains that have been made in treatment?
Yes, I mean, I think always the question when we're talking about gains is time frame. So, yes, it is very important that we have seen new surgical options that reduce, you know, previously the radical mastectomy, you know, to a simple mastectomy, to, you know, finding really that lumpectomy plus radiation has as good and even ever so slightly better outcomes. Unfortunately, we also see that more and more women are choosing mastectomies, and sometimes they're choosing them for non-life-threatening cancers or lesions like ductal carcinoma in situ, which by definition is non-invasive. And so we're really in this interesting spot where, you know, yes, tamoxifen, Herceptin, you know, Perjeta, there are a few number of highly effective therapies that have come onto the market, but we're seeing still 40,000 women die of breast cancer each and every year, and that number really isn't changing significantly. When our founders put out their call to the community to form for the first meetings for Breast Cancer Action, those flyers say 45,000 women died each year of breast cancer. 25 years later and billions of dollars later, it's still 40,000 women. And I think that while what screening is doing is bringing a lot of women into kind of this cancer pipeline, and I very much appreciate the comments that, you know, what mammography is very good at is finding particularly some early stage disease such as DCIS, which again is not invasive by definition. And the problem then is that we don't have a good way of deciding who is and is not going to undergo treatment. And so more and more women are undergoing treatment and bearing the harms of that without a significant reduction in the death rates. And I think, you know, this is clearly an important area of research right now.
Dr. Wheeler, what would you add to that? What explains the fact that 25 years ago, 45,000 women died every year, and today it's 40,000?
Correct. So we're still working on trying to catch cancer early. prevention, Karina was saying, is that we don't have a lot of data. We know that the majority of women that get diagnosed with breast cancer have no family history and have no risk factors. So we are actively pursuing that through foundations like the Canary Center, looking at what can we do to prevent breast cancer. And we'll probably talk about later lifestyle and weight loss and staying active, especially as we go through menopause, limiting alcohol intake. Those sorts of things are definitely helpful. And I think in the next several years, we're going to get more information as we get to do larger studies. But, you know, the reality is that we are catching breast cancers earlier, so the number of patients that get diagnosed with breast cancer, and I wholeheartedly agree, that includes DCIS, which we mostly consider stage zero breast cancer. In fact, some people would argue that it shouldn't be termed breast cancer because it is a completely different type of breast cancer, and, you know, breast cancer is very heterogeneous. Made up of various different subtypes, and we shouldn't be lumping all breast cancers together. But, you know, DCIS is something that we're actively looking at and trying to risk stratify and perhaps prevent doing invasive surgery on patients with lower grade DCIS. These are all trials that we're looking at because although we have come a long way, and we did, as you pointed out, started with a radical mastectomy when we first started treating breast cancer over 100 years ago, we're getting to becoming more personalized and less invasive with our treatments. But it is true, we can certainly do much more improvement, especially in the African-American population. Women that are African-American age less than 45 years of age have a higher incidence of breast cancer compared with women that are aged less than 45 years of other ethnicity. We're trying to look at that. We know that African American women that are young are much more likely to get a basal cell-like breast cancer, which means that it's lost all of its receptors. We also call that a triple negative breast cancer. Those are very aggressive cancers and can be more lethal than hormone receptor or estrogen receptor positive. So, you know, these disparities among how we treat breast cancer are definitely at the forefront, and a lot of research has gone into trying to figure out why this is. Is this due to lack of screening? Probably not all attributed. Is it due to lack of care or socioeconomic status? And, you know, quite frankly, we need to continue to push the envelope in this direction and further identify risk factors among women so that we can prevent breast cancer rather than treating it at a later stage or once it becomes more aggressive.
You mentioned DCIS, and help me with this. It's ductal carcinoma in situ?
In situ,
thank you. So we just got an email from Lise who says, please ask about DCIS. It's apparently the number one diagnosis as stage zero breast cancer, what you just mentioned. But Lise writes, but it's controversial if the word carcinoma should even be in the diagnostic name. I had lumpectomy and radiation, but perhaps those were unnecessary and over-treatment, as one of your guests just mentioned.
Yeah.
Karuna?
Yeah, this is, it's an important topic. So I want to just go big picture for a moment. So here we are about 30 years after the launch of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we're here in October. We call it sometimes Breast Cancer Industry Month. We, you know, almost 25 years after the launch of the Pink Ribbon, and you can't find a woman in the United States who's not aware of breast cancer. But perversely, women are... In general, most women overestimate their individual risk of breast cancer, and there's very little information that goes along with this awareness. And I would like to talk, you know, I hope we can get to a conversation about sort of pink ribbon culture and marketing and what that means and how and what it means when women are getting important public health messages from what are really corporate marketing teams that are selling pink ribbon products and putting what appear to be public health messages on them, but are really, you know, marketing messages. And so I think that's very important context when we are thinking about DCIS. So DCIS, as doctor said, is stage zero, and there is a push. Dr. Laura Essemerin at UCSF has been one of the voices leading a push to take the term carcinoma out, because carcinoma, sort of inflames the emotions. And it is not invasive. Now, as with all breast cancers, you can find different grades. And there may be some, you know, there's evidence to show that some DCIS may put women at higher risk for invasive cancer down the road. But there's others. The majority of DCIS will do nothing. They will go on to do nothing. And the fact of the matter is, DCIS is a product of mammography screening. You can't see it without mammograms. And so it's widely diagnosed. The more women we put through mammography screening, the more DCIS we find, and we don't yet have the tools to really properly separate it. And so there is a school of thought that says watchful waiting is a reasonable approach. We may not have to treat this. 70% of DCIS will do nothing. Why not watch, wait, monitor, surveil, see what happens? And if these women go on to develop an invasive cancer, it really will be caught in the earliest stages. And then, you know, women may choose to elect treatment.
Well, Elise, thank you so much for your question. And if you have a question about breast cancer, if you have a personal story to share, we'd love to hear from you. If you've been tested, if you've gone through treatment, if you have a loved one who has, if you work on this issue on breast cancer, we'd love to hear from you. And then also, we will definitely talk about the Pink products and Breast Cancer Action's Think Before You Pink campaign. They've got a new one out about a new package of makeup that was sent to breast cancer survivors, and some of the chemicals in that makeup is actually toxic. And so the Breast Cancer Action is calling out the Personal Care Products Council and the American Cancer Society. If you have any questions about the pink stuff or the walks, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And also treatment. How has that changed? And we'd love to hear your stories of treatment. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I'm joined by Karuna Jagger, Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action. It's a national nonprofit whose mission is to achieve health justice for all women. Breast Cancer Action does not take any funding from corporations, and they're the only breast cancer organization that has taken a stand against fracking and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And on Thursday night, tomorrow, they are going to have their 25th anniversary event at the Julia Morgan Ballroom, 6 to 9:30, and I'll be emceeing that event. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Dr. Amanda Wheeler, a board-certified surgeon who specializes in the surgical management of breast disease at Stanford. She is actively involved in clinical research and serves on the education committee for the American Society of Breast Surgeons. So let's talk a little bit more before we get into the pink campaigns and causes, just about some of the other gains that have been made in 25 years. Karuna, you said there have been a few breakthroughs.
Yeah, you know, I think that we're talking about these inequities. There is increasing focus on the inequities. And I think, as Dr. Wheeler said, we can't attribute the higher mortality rates of Black women to screening. Here in California, African American women are screened at ever so slightly higher rates than white women.
Really? How is that?
African-American women are screened. About 82% of African-American women have had a mammography in the last couple of years, compared to 80% of white women. So it's just, I'm seeing often issues of health inequity get set up in terms of lack of access and lack of care. And what I want to do is actually complicate this a little bit more and say that health inequities can look like a few things. One is too little care, which we're familiar with. Another is too much care. And the other, and also the wrong care. And so I think we have to be really attentive to the complexity that each of these can bring about harms to patients in real and tangible ways and produce a dramatic and important inequity between communities. We are talking about the fact that African American and Latina women are more likely to die of the disease. We haven't seen enough progress to really bridge that gap, but expanding that conversation beyond simply, we need to get those women into mammograms is important. That's not the solution. Here in California, again, Black women are getting screened and still they're more likely to die.
What explains that?
I think there's a lot of explanations. I mean, one is, you know, we haven't yet talked about some of the root causes of disease. And while, you know, Dr. Wheel and I agree that there is not enough information about root causes of disease, I think the evidence clearly points to environmental exposures, which are driving the increase of incidence in breast cancer and really driving a public health crisis. And different communities are exposed to different chemicals. And breast cancer is a heterogeneous disease. Different drivers drive different subtumors, and, you know, it may well be that these different exposures, you know, combined with biological differences of individuals can mean that certain communities are more likely to get certain more aggressive subtypes. That's speculative. We don't know, but that is, I do think it's very clear that environmental exposures are driving a breast cancer epidemic and a broader cancer epidemic in this country. I also want to say that differences in care, this goes back to some of the less tangible pieces of care, but, you know, Black women are undertreated for pain. Doctors are more likely to think that they're drug addicts. So we know that bias, cultural bias, plays out in the medical field as it does across our society. And we know that low-income women have significant barriers to getting care. Even with Affordable Care Act, you know, if you're going to do daily radiation treatments, you've got to, and maybe if you're young enough, you have a child, or if you're old enough, you have an elder person that you're taking care of. You have to take time off of work. You have to reliable transportation that gets you there. And there are multiple barriers to getting adequate care for really underserved communities. And again, you know, I want to broaden that underserved, so we know we have good data on, pretty good data on women of color. But, you know, rural women have gaps, very old women, very young women, you know, queer women, you know, transgender people. You know, there's a lot of places of disparity. And we're at least we're beginning to talk about this and beginning to research and understand it. But we've yet to really find the solutions to bridge those gaps.
Dr. Wheeler, how is the medical community dealing with the inequities that Karuna is talking about?
Right. So we do understand after some research that there are four main types of breast cancer. And in Black women, they are much more likely in the premenopausal age to get a basal cell-like breast cancer, which is a very aggressive subtype. So we've identified that there's a higher prevalence of a basal cell subtype in young premenopausal women. And so that helps us identify that cohort and treat them aggressively. What we're trying to figure out, and we do have some gene risk assessments, we have an oncotype test that we can do, even on DCIS patients in the African-American population, and help risk stratify. Is this really a wolf in sheep's clothing? Is this something that we should be aggressive and treat? Or is this really a sheep, something that we can, you know, maybe use less aggressive treatment on? We are well aware that there are disparities, and I think that's the first step. Of course, there is always unconscious bias, and I think that there's been a lot of literature in this space about how we do form unconscious opinions and treat patients based on that. But I think the more education and the more awareness we deliver through programs like this helps with the emotional diagnosis and the anxiety related to breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Just to go back on some things that had been discussed.
Actually, Dr. Wheeler, we have to take a quick break. Sorry to cut you off, but we're going to take a quick break here. We're talking today about breast cancer. And after the break, I'd also like to ask both of you about how women, what we should do with all of this information. I mean, my mom called me frantically recently saying, you've got to go have a mammogram. And people are inundated with so much information. So what should we do with all of that? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
We're going to have.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that hasn't been heard on today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. KALW is the media sponsor for the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, which presents its 2015-2016 Arts and Ideas season, featuring Maria Popova, who will discuss her popular blog, Brain Pickings. Thursday, October 15th, 7 p.m., information at jccsf.org/arts.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Sandra Steingraber, the environmental writer who spent 15 days in jail in November for protesting fracking in New York. When she was diagnosed with bladder cancer at age 20, she decided to make it her mission to study and expose the effects toxic chemicals have on our bodies and our planet. She says fracking is a public health disaster. So what does the science say? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about breast cancer. It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you're going to be hearing a lot of statistics. You'll see a lot of pink products at the stores. Those companies say that a portion of the money you spend will go towards breast cancer research. Just in a couple of minutes, we'll talk about how that money is actually spent. But today we're talking about the gains that have been made in treatment, what we know about breast cancer, what don't we know yet, why do 40,000 women still die from this disease every year? We'd love to hear from you. If you have had breast cancer, if you have it, if you're a survivor, if you know someone who has, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And what about unanswered questions? What unanswered questions do you have? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Karuna Jagger is Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action. This is a national nonprofit whose mission is to achieve health justice for all women at risk of and living with breast cancer. They don't take any money from corporations. They started the Think Before You Pink campaign, and their 25th anniversary event is tomorrow night at the Julia Morgan Ballroom in San Francisco, 6 o'clock, and I'll be emceeing. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Amanda Wheeler is a board-certified surgeon who specializes in the surgical management of breast disease at Stanford Health Center. And Dr. Wheeler, before the break, you were talking about inequities and how the medical industry is tackling those.
Right. I think we're doing a lot of research on gene analysis, trying to figure out are there different genetic mutations that lead to a more aggressive type of breast cancer, trying to figure out how do we target these more aggressive types of breast cancer. And they are different in different gene pools. And so, as I was talking about earlier, African Americans are much more likely to get a more aggressive type of breast cancer, a basal cell. And we think that that's one of the reasons why they don't do as well when we look at statistics. As Karina pointed out, we've done a great job in getting them access to care through mammography screening. And although mammography screening maybe doesn't need to be done every year on every single patient, there's still is the recommendation by the American Cancer Society as well as the American Society of Breast Surgeons that most women meet criteria for screening every year. So we know breast cancer is an emotional diagnosis and that without more education, women do choose mastectomies out of fear. In the U.S., over 50% of women right now are choosing mastectomies. So I think we're trying to do more education, be more proactive, and get the word out that, you know, women are doing very well when they get diagnosed with breast cancer, and we have all sorts of novel therapies that are using personalized medicine to target that therapy or to target their cancer with a specific therapy. And this has really led to an improved survival.
We could probably do a whole show on mammograms, but since this is very important, I wanted to ask you both about this. What are your thoughts about mammograms? A study by Gilbert Welch, a professor of medicine at Dartmouth, found that screenings induced overtreatment, that only 3 to 13% of women whose cancer was detected by mammograms actually benefited from this test. And then there's a piece that's getting a lot of attention on social media from Mother Jones. What if everything your doctor told you about breast cancer was wrong? And it says, for years, scientists have known that mammograms are largely ineffective. Why can't we get that message across? And I'm sure a lot of us, like my mom called me recently and said, go get a mammogram. So we have all this conflicting information. Karuna, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it's a really good question, and it seems so common sense, right? Catch it early, you'll do better. Unfortunately, breast cancer is more complex than that, and we do have to understand the biology, the very complex biology of breast cancer. For at the early phases of the sort of women's health movement, women were on the front lines of pushing for mammography screening as part of what was called preventive care. I mean, it doesn't prevent cancer, but, you know, the hope was it would prevent death. And over the years, a growing body of evidence has made clear that the promises of breast cancer, promises of early detection and of mammography screening for the average risk population have really been overstated, and we are not seeing the promised results. So what happens when an average risk woman goes to get a screening mammogram? And this might be a moment to pause and say that mammography is a tool, right? It's a technology, it's a device. It's a tool that can be used in different ways. So it can be used to diagnose something that was found by a woman or a health provider, right? So the symptom has appeared, and it's a diagnostic tool, and I'm not talking about that. It can be used to surveil high-risk women, so as part of a very intensive surveillance program for maybe women with BRCA mutations or women who have already had cancer, and I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about screening, which is putting the healthy population through a regimen of routine screening, so asymptomatic people looking for early signs of the disease. And I'm talking about population-based screening for average-risk women. And when we do that, the more you look, the more you find. That's basically what you see. And so mammography does pick up a lot of lesions that would not otherwise become apparent. So,
but how often does that happen? Because I recently had mine and I thought, well, precautionary principle, go get it and see, you know, what is it? What will it hurt?
Yeah. If 10,000 women undergo screening for 10 years, the majority of them will be called back for a false positive.
Something the majority?
Like, correct. Something like 60% will be called back at some point over those 10 years for a false positive. A false positive is not the same as an overdiagnosis. I'm not going to have my numbers on the top of my head. Didn't know we were doing this one. But in any event, there will be other cancers that will be found and treated, which would never have become life-threatening. And those women are overtreated. The definition is they receive treatment without benefit. They wouldn't have died of breast cancer. Maybe they would have died of something else, or maybe their breast cancer would never have spread and become life-threatening. And then you end up in this murkier area where women have very aggressive cancers. Well, unfortunately, we don't have treatments that are effective for some of those cancers. For a portion of those women, it doesn't matter when you find the cancer. We just don't have effective treatments, and those women will die anyway. And that leaves a very few women who may have their lives saved. But the data really shows that if we can prevent all the harms of overtreatment by simply waiting until the tumor presents manually, waiting until there's some, you know, kind of physically that you can kind of detect it, that this kind of lead time that mammography screening is supposed to give you. So the idea is that, you know, if you find it sooner than it can be felt, that's going to give you an advantage that will produce a better outcome. But because of this, you know, where our treatments are these days, that lead time conferred by mammography screening really doesn't confer an advantage in outcome.
So a listener says, I haven't had a mammogram yet. I'm honestly terrified about all of this. So what advice would you give people to do breast exams, and if you feel something at that point, go to the doctor?
I think that, you know, the data is even, we don't even, this goes again, like, are we going to pathologize our breasts and go out looking
right,
for things?
Right.
And truly, the data on self-exam is not great. So I think clearly, if any woman has a symptom, anything she's concerned about, absolutely get that checked out. Know your risk, and that's a hard thing to say because we don't have good risk assessment tools for many women. But if someone, you know, has a very high family history or has been exposed to radiation at a young age, there's some risk factors that are known risk factors, DES daughters, you know, that they're in higher risk category. But for most women, I think the best thing you can do is actually spend some time understanding the data and reflecting on your values and your priorities. Because yes, it is an emotional issue. And I think too often the conversation gets skewed towards early detection saves lives, and there's no real attention or acknowledgement of the real lived harms of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. These are lifelong harms, financial, physical, psychological harms that are, you know, we need to consider, and tens of thousands of women are overtreated for breast cancer each and every year.
Dr. Willer, what are your thoughts on this, so especially the increase in false positives?
Right. So the goal, the national goal, is to have a callback rate of about 6 to 10% of patients that get mammography screening. And as Karina pointed out, these are women that are asymptomatic. I do advocate self-breast awareness, so I do want women to be comfortable with their breasts, just like we're comfortable with the rest of our body. I always tell women, you know, if your finger hurts, you're going to look at it. You're sort of going to, you know, make sure that there's no injury there. And I advocate that women look at their breasts when they're in the shower and feel them and be comfortable with them, just like any other body part. We look at our face all the time, so we should do the same for our breasts. I also advocate that women need to be proactive, and they need to understand their individual risk and make a benefit decision that's based on their own individual and personal risk assessment. And that's really a discussion between the physician and the patient. It's hard to make a blanket statement that no or that every woman is of average risk. As Karina pointed out, there's lots of different risks. And I think that, you know, we need to make sure that women are educated, they understand what their individual risk is, and that they also understand that there is potential harm to any test that is done, but there's also potential gain. And I think that's an individual decision for the patient. And I certainly counsel my patients when I order studies regarding that risk assessment profile.
And so what tips would you have for people who are unclear about whether they should have a mammogram?
Well, I think they should definitely talk to their primary care doctor, who knows them best and can assess whether or not they have risk factors. It goes beyond just the family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. There's other risk factors like mantle radiation for women that have had lymphoma. There's risk factors in women that are obese. There's risk factors in women that take hormone replacement therapy or perhaps, you know, have other lifestyle factors in their background. And that's why it's, I think, a personal decision, and it's a discussion that should be had with their primary care doctor, just like any other screening tool.
Dr. Amanda Wheeler is a board-certified surgeon who specializes in the surgical management of breast disease at Stanford Health Center, and Karuna Jagger is executive director of Breast Cancer Action, a nonprofit whose mission is to achieve health justice for all women at risk of and living with breast cancer. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about breast cancer, where we are today after decades of a lot of awareness and so much money spent on research, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Adeline in Monterey. Hi, Adeline. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I guess my comment is the fact that it's true. As a college student, you hear all these complaints about, like, we don't really know anything about breast cancer. You know, like, certain things we hear on TV shows, like, if you don't get pregnant, you might get breast cancer. I mean, that's very scary as you're coming into that age when you start to have to worry about it and everything like that. So I guess my comment is the fact that I'm glad that you guys are mentioning all the, like, factors and, like, certain things like alcohol use and stuff like that, because something to keep in mind, but I hope not to worry anyone.
Karuna?
Hi, Adeline. You know, your experience is so common for women, and I think that one of the real unintended consequences of this just widespread mainstream push for breast cancer awareness is that we have pushed breast cancer awareness into college kids, to women in their 20s. And, you know, Peggy Orenstein wrote a great piece for the New York Times, and she, towards the end, has this just fantastic line that says, listen, A woman in her 20s risk of getting breast cancer is about the same as a man in his 70s getting breast cancer. But we're not telling him to feel his boobies. And I think this is, you know, one of the things that I feel very protective about is that, you know, most women, white women in particular, overestimate their individual risk of breast cancer. Women have come to fear their breasts. And I think it's just a real travesty that young women coming into their bodies and their sexuality are sort of taught that breasts are ticking time bombs. You know, we do have a public health crisis on our hands. We have a social justice crisis on our hands. And we need to address that as a society and as an economy. And at the same time, I feel the need to push back on some of the fear mongering that to me is coming, again, not from health experts. It's coming from corporations that are seeing new markets for little pink bracelets that say I heart boobies. And it's about corporate marketers expanding their market and reaching to young women and telling them that they can be at risk of breast cancer so that they can sell some products and make this an urgent and important issue. But, you know, the downside is that young women are afraid of breast cancer. And, you know, men in their 70s are not living in the same state of fear.
Dr. Wheeler, what are your thoughts on that? Karuna's right. I mean, so many young people now talk about cancer, and for reasons. I mean, a lot of young people, a lot of friends of friends, you hear about people dying from cancer on a regular basis. Yeah. I'm not necessarily saying it's breast cancer, well, but just cancer.
I mean, that's the sort of flip side. It's like, right. It is also true, and I think, again, points to some of the environmental risk factors, that we're seeing an increase in advanced disease in young women. So, you know, I'm not saying that young women are at no risk, and there is an alarming trend that more young women are being diagnosed at advanced stage, which is to say metastatic disease. But relatively, you know, the risk still remains quite low. And I think that the fact that so many young women are the target of marketing campaigns, they're not getting good information. They're not finding out what they can do. They're really being urged to buy some products.
Well, because so many makeup companies now are coming out with pink products, and they're targeting teens and young women. Dr. Wheeler, how does the medical industry deal with all of this pink stuff? I mean, pink eyeshadow, pink lipstick, pink drill bits, pink Kentucky Fried Chicken, you name it. I mean, so many things are pink these days.
Right. I was watching football and there's pink gloves, which caught my eye. So, you know, fear breeds on lack of knowledge. And I think doing programs like these, doing more awareness for women, even young women, so that they understand what their actual risk is. And it is very true, women always overstate their individual risk of breast cancer. Even women that have had breast cancer will state their future risk of another breast cancer much higher. And we need to continue to work on education. You know, there is a flip side, too, and that is that women often do have a family member or know of someone that's had breast cancer and hasn't done very well. And so sometimes that'll actually prevent women from seeking care when they need to. So it goes both ways. We have women that, you know, come into the emergency room with a 10-centimeter ulcerating mass that's bleeding because they were so afraid to bring it to the attention of their doctor early on because they were told that, oh, you know, you're going to have a deforming surgery and you're, you know, just going to die of the disease anyways. So I think full circle, we need to improve education to all women of all ages, and that I agree, we need to become more educated so that we don't make choices out of fear. I do think it is a very lucrative industry, and it's taken on its own light in advertising. But, it, you know, it's very similar to, you know, holidays around here, too. Those are huge industry makers, and so they get publicized. And I think that, you know, as women, we should be smarter than this. We should educate ourselves. I think continue the discussion. Programs like this help us talk about what are the actual risk factors and what is the actual risk of dying of breast cancer. And the reality is it's about 2%, 2 to 5%. That's the actual risk of dying of any stage breast cancer in the U.S. So we're talking about a very, very low probability. And I think we've brought up all of these issues very well in this program, and hopefully this will continue the discussion, and women will continue to have more informative discussions with their primary care doctors, as well as with their friends and family, so that it doesn't have such a negative connotation when you hear the word breast cancer.
Well, thank you for calling in, Adeline. Let's hear from Angela in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Angela. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all this incredibly good work you guys are doing. I was diagnosed with DCIS and stage 1 breast cancer about 12 years ago at the age of 41. I was treated with the full multimodal treatments, including adjuvant chemo, mastectomy, radiation, and tamoxifen. And I'm quote-unquote cured, according to my doctor at the time. And back in those days, I had a lot of friends in a cancer support group, and we used to joke about something called chemo brain, which is where you just feel completely out of it and can't think straight. Here it is about 12 years later, and I still feel a little bit hazy. I'm an extremely healthy person, and I have two questions. One is, do you think that I'm... is this just getting older, my memory, and just feeling a little bit slow in the head? Or do you think it could be a long-term effect from chemo? And then my second question is, would having aggressive chemo earlier in my life put me at a higher risk for Alzheimer's later on in my life?
So there's Dr. Wheeler.
Sure. So there's no data that shows that chemotherapy, to my knowledge, increases your risk of Alzheimer's. But chemo brain is real. We have done lots of studies on it, and this is why survivorship is sort of the next leading edge to treating breast cancer patients. We have given lots of therapies over the years that have been harmful with benefit, but there are lasting effects, and there's been a lot of data that shows that doing cognitive behavioral therapy can help with the lasting effects of chemotherapy. It is also true, unfortunately, that as we go through menopause, we do have more memory problems and, you know, have cognitive defects. So it also is a sign of aging. But, you know, we do have very good data that shows that chemo brain is real and that, you know, this is one of the side effects of the treatment that we prescribe.
Is there anything Angela can do about chemo brain, Karuna?
I don't know that it's reversible. I think for many women, it's very validating to hear that it's not in their head and that it's not just that they, aren't picking themselves up fast enough, right? We get a lot of messages in mainstream sort of breast cancer awareness movements, fight hard, stay positive, do your makeup, and, you know, you're going to get through this and you'll be as good as new. And I think it can be really demoralizing for women who are living with the long-term health effects of treatment. And, you know, they can include long-term permanent neurologic problems, lymphedema, you know, heart disease from both radiation and some of the chemotherapies is a real risk factor for women who've been through breast cancer treatment. And chemo brain is this, you know, it's been this thing, you know, as she said, she and her friends knew what was happening and it took a while for researchers to catch up. But it's validating to know that, you know, this is not your weakness or your sort of failure to kind of bounce back.
Right. Is anyone doing studies on this, like how sleep might affect this, how diet might affect this, how changes in certain lifestyle choices might affect and make this better? Is the research being done on that?
I can't speak to the specific combination of topics. I don't know if you can, Dr. Wheeler, but yes, it is an area of research. And I think, I think there's sort of two takeaways. One is, you know, understanding the scope of the problem. And my interest is preventing the problem by making sure that only those women that really benefit from treatment get it, that we really acknowledge the true lifelong serious harms of overtreatment. Because believe me, there's no one more than me. You know, I run a national breast cancer organization. There's no one who wants to save lives more than me. But I want to do that without creating an entire community of survivors who've, you know, so-called survivors who've been treated for something that didn't help them.
So we could do a whole topic on prevention and causes, a whole hour, but we have a few minutes left. And I just want to ask you both about prevention, because there's so much focus on finding the cure. And what about prevention and also causes? We have an email from Ron who says, orange is the new pink this Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And he sent a piece from Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine saying that women should swap their pink ribbons for orange vegetables if they really want to improve the odds of fighting the disease. There's a bunch of new studies out there about increasing fruits and vegetables to reduce the risk. So, Dr. Wheeler, what does the data tell us about that, and what are your thoughts on prevention?
Sure. I mean, we are a glutton society, right? We are getting more obese and have unhealthy habits, and we can do a lot in preventing not just breast cancer, but other cancers by eating better, eating healthier, limiting, you know, bad food choices and increasing our fruits and vegetables, you know, the food, going back to the food pyramid. We also, you know, can exercise more. You know, we should probably get daily exercise, 30 minutes, 5 days a week, where our heart rate gets elevated. And, you know, most women that I ask that question, they're not quite getting that. Sleep is a big issue. You know, we know that sleep habits can impact our ability to handle stress in life, and we know that stress increases inflammatory markers and can also increase risk factors. And also, you know, as we get older, we can improve our cognitive abilities by, you know, adapting and taking on new activities. There was studies that showed that women that did have cognitive deficits after treatment, that if they took on a new activity that was different, so if they picked up piano classes or learning a musical instrument, that they actually could improve their cognition, which also just is part of our aging. So we definitely need to improve our lifestyle. I think that we hear this all the time from the doctor's office, but now is probably the time to act. We know that when women that lose weight as they go through menopause decrease their risk of breast cancer.
And I just want to, we have about 30 seconds, and I also wanted Karuna to tackle that question.
Yes. So thank you. There's no question that living healthy is good for us and our overall bodies. We also know that not all women in all communities have equal opportunities when it comes to fresh fruits and vegetables, exercise, etc. But the real truth is that we know too many women who have done all the right things and have died of breast cancer anyway, and we cannot continue to put the burden on women to be our own, not only our lifestyle, but also to protect ourselves from the chemicals that are increasing the risk of breast cancer. We need strong regulation that protects all of us, including the most vulnerable, from chemicals that we're exposed to throughout the course of our lives in unknown doses and quantities and are increasing the risk of breast cancer.
And we're going to talk about that tomorrow in more detail. Karuna Jagger is Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action, and Dr. Amanda Wheeler is a board-certified surgeon who specializes in the surgical management of breast disease at Stanford. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's the latest science on the environmental and public health impacts of fracking? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Sandra Steingraber, the environmental writer who spent 15 days in jail in November for protesting fracking in New York. Since she was diagnosed with bladder cancer at 20, Steingraber's made it her mission to study and expose the effects toxic chemicals have on our bodies and our planet. She says fracking is a public health disaster. What does the science say? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.